All right, you're listening to KZUM 89.3. My name is Ben Noss. I'm your host this evening in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we're here with Marilyn Savage and Bill Moorwinkle to talk a little bit about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
My name is Marilyn Savage, and I'm a Kuchin Indian. I was born and raised in Fort Yukon, Alaska, and we're traveling to give our voice and talk about our lifestyle. When I grew up in Fort Yukon, I grew up from the land, and we grew up just on subsistence activities, and our food chain was all animals. Well, I raised three kids. I have a young daughter, 5, who I adopted, so she's traveling with me, and I'm a native language teacher. I teach native language when I can. I speak my own language, which is Kuchin Athabaskan, and I come from a large family in Fort Yukon, and there's 13 of us. My grandmother had 16, so Kuchin people have large families. But I notice these days now, people have only a few kids. And traveling to talk about saving the caribou, saving their calving grounds from oil development.
Bill, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Bill Moorwinkle. I live in Palmer, Alaska, and I've been a wilderness guide up in the Arctic Refuge for about 10 years now. I have been leading backpacking and rafting, canoeing, kayaking trips up in the refuge, and I came down here just to talk about the refuge and the need to protect it. It's a pretty special place, and we're doing some slideshows around Nebraska and Iowa for a couple of weeks, and it's been a blast. It's been really fun traveling with Marilyn and getting to know her a little bit better, and meeting lots of Nebraskans and talking a lot about sandhill cranes.
For the people that are listening out there, George Bush and a number of other government officials and folks in the oil industry want to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drill for oil, which will have a devastating effect on the land up there and the Gwich'in people and their way of life. Marilyn, could you talk a little bit about your people, the Gwich'in people?
The Gwich'in people have been living in the interior of Alaska, and Fort Yukon is 8 miles above the Arctic Circle, and there's about 10 to 12 small communities in the Yukon Flats, and the Gwich'in span over into Canada, too, that are related to us, and there's Gwich'ins there. We have family. We're interrelated. The Gwich'ins are nomadic people from thousands of generations back, and today still we survive on our animal and our subsistence lifestyle. Our main diet is from moose and caribou and the salmon fish and geese that fly up there in the spring and berries that grow there. Our diet is from the wildlife, which is about 75% to 85% of our food supply. So we harvest each of these in our when it's time to harvest them, when they come to us. And we have great respect for the animals and the land. So we survive from them, and we try to take care of them too. In the summertime, when the ice breaks up and the water's flowing and the fish come back, we start getting ready for fishing. So get a supply of salmon. We had a poor run the last couple of years, so it's been hard for fish. The porcupine caribou has been traveling on this migration route, and it goes up through they go through Canada and through interior Alaska, travel up to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where they begin the process for calving, have their young calves. We start hunting in October. We have to go by boats, and we see them cross on the Porcupine River. the caribou, the porcupine caribou herd, it's a herd of 130,000, and their calving ground is up there in the northeast of Alaska, covering millions of, 1.5 million acres. And anyway, they go up there, that's a flat area in the coastal plain there, and their mind says it's time to calf, and they head up there. And they get relief from the mosquitoes because it's a sacred birthing grounds, and we respect their birthing grounds. And the mosquitoes bother them, so that's where they go from the The ocean gives a wind, cool wind, and they've been on this long trip, and they want peace and quiet, and they calve. And then they take their young a few months later and cross the Porcupine River. There's Athabascan Quechins that live the interior and subsist off this caribou herd. And then there's Inupiat Eskimos live north on the coastal plains. They're Kaktovik. And there's Eskimo communities up north of in that area. They subsist off the whales. Their subsistence activity is off out of the sea, and very little from the porcupine. They depend more on the revenues of the oil drilling from Prudhoe Bay. It's just the only place in the world that this calving herd could have their nursery. And it's to us, it's a sacred place, and we wanted to keep it sacred so they could continue to do this process. Well, of course, the president in the Congressional Alaska delegation wants to open this area called 1002 to drill for oil. And so it's going to threaten our lifestyle. And the Quechin people, who are few in number compared to the rest of the United States, are working really hard because we don't have the money the oil companies have or the Inupiats have. I mean, they benefit from the revenues from the oil company. We're just a small group of people, and we don't have the oil money. We're not opposed to oil drilling, but just this one little place that's protection for wildlife, not only to porcupine caribou herd, to birds, and to all kinds of birds from other countries come up here in the migration route and land their nest. It's, like I said, very sacred place. People in Washington and Alaska delegation, I said, want to open this place to drilling. There'll be no sacred birthing grounds, and there'll be no place for them to go, which will affect the Quechin people drastically. I mean, that's our culture. We've known, this is all we've known, is to live from the caribou. You know, we survive from them, and they help us through famines thousands of years ago. It's just a big fight to keep it calving grounds, keep it sacred. It's been a pressure to protect our lifestyle. It's caused divisions between people. We don't have the support of the Eskimos from the north. You know, they want to open it for drilling. Their lifestyle is off the ocean there, you know, their whales and... they wouldn't go offshore drilling because they'll disrupt their subsistence activities. But there's our fight is because there won't be nothing after the oil drilling. There will be no animals. There will be no tribes will be displaced. And, I mean, that's a threat to our very existence. I don't agree with him that it's going to be just a clean-cut operation. You know, we have rivers up there, and just drilling for oil, they're going to be blowing up the area, and the animals be displaced, like I said, and you know, accidents will happen, and get in the rivers, be no fish, and... just anything could happen, and I just don't agree with them. It's a sacred area. I mean, I think they should just realize it is and respect the animals on it. Maybe Bill could interject here.
I was at a public hearing not too long ago. They're trying to open the area to the west of Prudhoe Bay. It's a large area called MPRA. It's about 30 million acres. And they've already opened part of it for oil development. It's around a native community called Nuiqsiq. And at this public hearing, this woman showed up who is the tribal leader. And they had agreed, they made an agreement with the oil companies to develop their land. And she was there to testify that they have found it was a huge mistake. And it has significantly impacted their lives. They are no longer allowed to hunt and gather food on their lands that they have for thousands of years. The oil company promised that they wouldn't develop their land close to their village, and now they're within 8 miles of their village. She was talking about over 1,600 flights a month that go over their village, and it's just been incredibly disruptive. And she was basically there to ask for help and to let people know that the claims of oil companies that they're going to do this responsibly and respectfully were not simply not true.
Do you know how the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was created?
Yeah, it was 1960. President Eisenhower designated about 9 million acres in the northeast corner of Alaska as the Arctic National Wildlife Range, and it was designated for its wildlife, wilderness, and recreational values. In 1980, thanks in part to Jimmy Carter, ANILCA was passed, which is the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which designated a lot of wilderness and refuge land in Alaska. For the refuge, it increased its size to about 20 million acres, and it designated 8 million acres as wilderness, and it was called the Arctic Refuge now. What's unfortunate, though, is that during that designation, there was an area left out. It was called 1002 of ANILCA that was left out, about 1.5 million acres, and Marilyn's been talking about this. It's she described it as a nursery, and that's exactly what it is. It's the heart of the refuge. It's where the caribou, porcupine caribou herd come to have their calves, and 180 different species of birds come to nest. It's just a very vital place that was left out of this wilderness designation, and this is the area that they're trying to develop it for oil.
Why was it left out?
They had a Ronald Reagan was coming into office. Jimmy Carter had lost the election, and they knew that they were either going to have to compromise or lose everything. So they made a compromise to leave this section out for future oil development, and hoping that actually someday that we would designate it as wilderness, complete the wilderness and designation in the refuge.
Could you talk a little bit about how the Bush administration's efforts to exploit the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge has changed from previous administrations?
Well, I think, you know, some of their biggest tactics, in my opinion, is to spread a lot of misinformation about this place. And that's why Marilyn and I are traveling around, is to try to let people know what this place is really all about. Some of the common myths that the oil company and the administration want you to think is that this is a barren wasteland. You know, I've heard that term thrown around a lot. We actually had a senator who's now our governor, Frank Murkowski, hold up a blank sheet of paper on the Senate floor and say, this is the Arctic Refuge. This is what's out there. There's nothing. It's blank. It's a barren wasteland. And it's very, very far from the truth. I spent 10 summers now traveling through this area and have guided and traveled all over the country and all over the world, and this is the most spectacular place that I've ever been and the most alive place I've ever been. And you know, some of the other myths that they like to talk about is that, and Marilyn's already talked a little bit about this, but the idea that oil and wilderness can coexist, and simply not true. I've toured Prudhoe Bay. I've flown over it. I've flown over various satellite fields that they have around. Right now, Prudhoe Bay spans about 1,000 square miles, and it's the largest single industrial complex in the world. And that's what they're talking about putting into the heart of the refuge right now. I guess also with a lot of world events that are going on right now, there's a lot of talk of needing this oil for national security, which is also, again, misinformation. Right now, we in the U.S. consume about 25% of the world's resources, and we hold about 3% in reserves. So there's really no possible way that we will be able to drill our way to national security or independence from foreign oil. And the only way that we're going to be able to do that is through conservation and through seeking alternative ways to get our energy. There's, you know, if we actually, you know, increased our mileage of our cars by 3 miles per gallon, we would save about 1 million barrels of oil a day, and we would go towards a path in reducing our dependency on foreign oil. We would save this amazing place, this wilderness that we call the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and we would save a culture that has subsisted off of this caribou and have lived in harmony with the environment up there for thousands of years. You know, sooner or later, we're going to have to go down a road where we're going to do without oil. I mean, it's going to run out sometime, and it's just a matter of when we're going to decide to seek alternative energy sources. And it seems like right now is a pretty good time that we need to start realizing that the party's over, and we need to stop destroying our places and stop destroying our native cultures and be smarter, look towards the future, and create, you know, a positive way to get to reach our energy needs. Prudhoe Bay has about 400 spills per year that are reported, oil spills, that is. They have about twice the nitrogen oxide output as a large city like Washington, D.C., so there's a pretty amazing amount of pollution. The noise that's associated with it, the airplanes that move in and out. The oil companies also like to use a lot that there's a caribou herd over in that area called the Central Arctic Caribou Herd. And historically, their numbers have been increasing over the years. Even they were increasing even before Prudhoe Bay really existed. And they like to say, look, these caribou are doing fine. Their numbers are increasing. What they don't tell you is that the herd has been displaced. It's had to move pretty far south to have their calves. The calves typically have had lower birth weights because of the stress from moving and the stress from all the activity. And really the important thing to note is that, and it's like Marilyn said, the caribou in the Arctic Refuge have no place to go. You know, if they were to develop oil there, the coast, Arctic coast, the 1002 area that we're talking about is a pretty thin strip of land compared to the rest of the coast, because there's mountains that come within 30 miles of the coast, and really these caribou have no place to go.
It's not worth the amount of oil that they want to drill 1002 area. It's got, what, a 6 months supply of oil? And then what? I mean, they've destroyed an area that's sacred.
The stuff that I've read about it says that it's going to take quite a while, like a decade or so even, to get access to some of that oil. And I mean, if it's only 6 months supply, then why not spend those 10 years like developing other technology that you can, you know, apply just as well? A lot of that technology already exists.
Yeah, and it's really good to see too here in Nebraska all these wind turbines that are popping up around. And you know, I think that is an example of a very forward-thinking, creative way to meet our energy needs. And you know, I've actually read about in a lot of places in the Midwest where they're actually paying farmers to farm wind.
Is there anything else that either of you'd like to add?
Yeah, I guess for me, I'd just like people to know, or my feeling of this place is that this is kind of drawing a line in the sand, saying enough is enough. And I really believe that if we let this place be open to oil development, that nothing will be sacred anymore, that everything will be open to our consumption, and we won't have this notion in this country that there are things that should be left alone, that we should protect this area, and this place exists for the animals and for the people who need it. And, you know, I just think it would be sad to say that nothing is sacred from our consumption. And I hope that we people out there will work to protect this place.
I really enjoy my culture. It's a rich culture. We, as a Gwich'in group, support each other, and our activities is all about animals and birds and fish, and we raise our families to do the same. And I can't explain the wealth of love we get from our families, because we get to go out in the boats and go fishing. We get to take care of our animals and get our winter supply of food. Just going out and doing that, you know, it's just a real spiritual movement for us, and oil is not going to give us our culture back.
Now with this, we have Kate Jackson with the Alaska Coalition. Kate, could you talk a little bit about why you're here in Nebraska?
We're here in Nebraska because it's one of the critical swing states in the country. As those of you who follow politics probably know, Senator Ben Nelson was actually a great leader on the issue of Arctic drilling last year. He voted to protect the Arctic, and it looks like he's going to do the same now. We have other challenges, though. We have Senator Hagel and Congressman B. Ryder, and we're reaching out to them through call-in days, through letter-writing campaigns, telling them that there are a lot of myths about the Arctic, that it's this, you know, bleak, dark tundra, nothing but just snow and a lifeless, barren wasteland. We have dispelled those myths through the slideshow that we've been traveling around the state with, showing the snowy owls and the musk oxen and the sandhill cranes, which are so essential to the economy and the pride of the state of Nebraska. So we're encouraging Senators Hagel and Nelson to vote the right way on the issue, and for Congressman B. Ryder to do the same. And we're working in 13 critical swing states around the country. Nebraska gets to be one of those. So a couple of things we're doing. The slideshow is one, and we'll be traveling around the state with that now and in a few weeks from now as well. So for those of you who didn't get to see the show, you'll have another chance. In addition, we're building a coalition. Right now, the Alaska Coalition represents 600 local and national organizations. But the more labor and agriculture, religious, Native American communities we can get behind this effort, the more we substantiate that this is an issue for the American people. And finally, most importantly, what you can do. Call and write to senators and congressmen. The switchboard number in D.C. is 202-224-3121. You can also get the addresses of your congressmen and senators from the web. It's really important to write them. We were actually really encouraged when we had a call-in day to B. Ryder's office. They said B. Ryder himself called the Alaska Coalition wondering what was going on with all these phone calls and why Nebraskans were so curious. So it speaks to the power of old school picking up the phone and writing that letter. Most importantly as well is to know the political landscape that we're dealing with right now. George Bush, the president of our country, has put Arctic drilling into the nation's budget. Now, for anyone who's a political buff, they know that it only takes 50 votes to pass the budget. It takes a two-thirds majority to pass any other bill. So with Arctic drilling in the budget and other critical expenditures like Medicare and Medicaid, it's more likely that senators and congressmen are going to feel compelled to vote for the budget even though the Arctic drilling issue is in there, because they have other critical things for their state that they want to get passed. What we're working really hard to do right now is to prevent Arctic drilling from being in the Senate and House versions of the budget. So that can be a particular ask within your letter. Please don't let this be in the budget. Please don't let it be anywhere, because drilling in the Arctic is wrong. For a state like Nebraska, we should turn to wind. We should turn to other alternative energies. That would actually mean jobs and growth for the state of Nebraska. There's not a whole lot of jobs for Nebraskans out of drilling in the Arctic. If anything, with the loss of sandhill cranes, because their habitat will be destroyed, there's job loss for Nebraskans, because there's so much infrastructure and tourism behind the return of the sandhill cranes.
Could you talk a little bit about how the sandhill cranes will be affected?
Sure. It's the migration and nesting ground for sandhill cranes. Now, they go to other places in Canada as well, but the Arctic is one of the essential breeding grounds for the cranes. So when that is disturbed, there's, as Bill probably mentioned, the Brooks Range just to the south of the Arctic. There's no other place for them to go besides this critical coastal plain, the 1002 area, where drilling is set to go forth if the administration and oil industries have their way. So there's also 30 species in total of migratory birds that come to Nebraska, which call the Arctic home for part of the year. So in that sense, it's really important. If people are curious to learn more about this issue, I'd be really excited to have more people on board with the campaign. My name is Kate Jackson again. My email address is kate@alaskacoalition.org. You can get more information at alaskawild.org on the web. And my phone number is 402-475-5066. I'm in the terminal building in Lincoln. And I would be really thrilled to hear from any of you who are interested to get involved. One of the reasons why I first got involved with environmental issues, and particularly a grassroots approach to running environmental campaigns, was after spending a summer in Washington, D.C., and listening to testimony on the Senate and House floors. It really astonished me that senators and congressmen were getting away with saying things that, if I'd ever written them on a test, I would have failed that test. I wouldn't have passed seventh grade with the kind of science and logic that they were using. There was an issue where oil drilling was possibly going to go forward in other national parks like the Valley of the Kings. And a Senate Republican was saying that he didn't believe that the Valley of the Kings was a very old place, and that a lot of these stories of Native Americans were always exaggerated. And another senator luckily interjected and said, "Sir, I just visited that burial ground. It's actually a 5,000-year-old burial ground. I think it would be really inappropriate to drill there." And to think that if that senator hadn't been on the floor at the time to contradict this really false testimony, we possibly could have had such a historic and important place drilled for oil, I think just speaks to the need to get involved now, the need for us to be those senators who say, "That's not right, and I'm going to hold you accountable." And I think the last thing to take away is that it can be really fun and inspiring and empowering to speak truth to power, that this isn't a drag on our time to have to pick up the phone or write a letter to our senator or congressman, that being an active citizen can be just as fun, if not more so, than being an active consumer.
All right, you've been listening to KZUM 89.3. We've had an interview with Marilyn Savage, Bill Moorwinkle, and Kate Jackson. For more information about KZUM, you can visit the website at kzum.org or call us at 402-475-4620. My name's Ben. I've been your host this evening. Thanks for listening.